Hello, my name is Rebecca Lybrand. I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Crop and Soil Science at Oregon State University, and the title of my talk today is Examining the Incipient Stages of Mineral Weathering in Semi-Arid and Humid Landscapes. The focus of my presentation will be on mineral weathering in the critical zone, and my talk today will be composed of four parts, including an overview, a summary of the cross-scale weathering work that we have been working on at the Catalina Critical Zone Observatory, and then how that has led to the study of incipient weathering in the Catalina as well as the Calhoun Critical Zone Observatory located in South Carolina. And then I will finish up with a few of the current and future research directions planned for this work. So when we talk about mineral weathering, we are emphasizing processes that transform bedrock to weathered rock and soil that supports terrestrial ecosystems, filters the groundwater that we all need to survive, and also plays a significant role in the global carbon cycle. And then when we start thinking about mineral weathering in natural systems, we already understand there is a great degree of complexity in what the soil environment looks like, ranging from smaller weatherable minerals, clays, quartz, mica, depending on the parent material. But something that I'm really interested in is what about the abiotic and biotic drivers of these weathering processes? And how do fungi specifically that you have in the soil drive or catalyze mineral weathering in these types of landscapes? So while there's a lot of emphasis on how water and other types of atmospheric inputs may drive soil development and weathering processes, I also think it's important to be thinking about how these other dynamic aspects of the ecosystem come into play as well. And we all know that microbes play an important role in decomposition processes, soil respiration, and nutrient cycling. But one of the things that is most intriguing to me is a bit of the disconnect that we can sometimes see in how this is presented. So we focus on mineral weathering processes, the release of nutrients that are taken up by plants, and we are also focused on microorganisms, decomposition processes, organic matter transformations. But a question that I have is how are microbes driving or catalyzing mineral weathering processes in natural systems. So this work builds on some previous work that I worked on in Arizona at the Catalina Critical Zone Observatory, where our field sites span from desert scrub, grasslands and oak woodlands, pine, to mixed conifer environments. And I was specifically interested in some of this cross-scale weathering work. So how can you track your soil development at the pedon scale to looking at bulk soils, mineral and elemental depletions and enrichments, which is what we'll focus on today, and then getting down to the microscale of study, where you can look at the complete or incomplete transformations of mineral grains, depending on the type of ecosystem that you're in. And this all centers back to one of the overarching questions for the CZO and to some of my research, which is how do vegetation, climate, and landscape position drive critical zone processes and interactions? And my specific emphasis was on soil carbon storage and mineral weathering in these systems. So this work took place in the Santa Catalina Mountains, located in southern Arizona. And the specific sites within the Catalina CZO ranges from desert scrub to mixed conifer environments. So this spans a precipitation gradient of 25 to 85 centimeters, with mean annual temperatures ranging from 24 to 10 degrees Celsius. The geology of these sites is granitic. For the most part, the mineralogy is quite similar between the two bedrock types. There's just slight mineralogical differences, primarily related to the micas. And the other aspect of my presentation today that you'll be hearing throughout the rest of this talk is these differences in landscape positions. So thinking about divergent watershedding landscapes as well as convergent water gathering landscape positions. So we'll be coming back to that. So this was set up as an environmental gradient study and thinking about the influence of landscape position at the watershed scale. The first round of results will be focused on tau plots, and the general breakdown of these plots is y-axis will contain soil depth, tau will be on the x-axis, and the main thing to remember that anything falling along this zero line represents 0% change from the parent material. Anything falling to the right represents an enrichment in the mobile element or mineral that we're looking at. This could be related to biocycling, dust deposition, other types of factors. And then anything to the left is a depletion in the mobile element or mineral. So this is what we would be looking at in terms of potential evidence for mineral weathering processes. So our first round of results here in the mixed conifer system, this is a wetter, more productive type of ecosystem compared to the desert, and we see evidence for mineral and elemental depletions, with the first being for total feldspars. And the blue here represents the convergent water gathering position, so we see a greater degree of feldspar loss in these lowland landscapes compared to these divergent positions where this is falling more along the lines of 0% change from the parent material. Interestingly, the muscovite mica did not show evidence for a lot of loss in these environments. And when we move down to the elements, again, sodium can be used as a proxy for feldspar weathering. So we're also seeing that at this scale. So thinking about the elemental losses in these landscape positions, again, these convergent landscapes are showing a greater degree of loss compared to the divergent sites. We see the same type of evidence in terms of desilication processes and then also for potassium and calcium. Things get a bit more interesting when we go to the desert scrub site. As you can immediately see, we are to the right of the 0% change from parent material, which is indicating that we likely have some dust deposition, which I'll be getting to momentarily. But something that adds to this is the large amount of biotite that we're seeing evidence for. This is a very strong enrichment in biotite, especially in the surface soils. But what caught our attention was that when we went to the elements, we're seeing depletions in sodium. Again, this evidence for desilication and losses of potassium and calcium. And this is, again, not as pronounced as the mixed conifer system, but you can still see as we move through these that it's slightly more loss that we're seeing in the convergent landscape positions compared to the divergent positions. So we are attributing this enrichment in minerals and the depletion in the base cations to dust deposition, to the deposition of weathered materials that comes in from these extensive dust storms that are experienced in southern Arizona. And we went through the geochemical calculation to estimate some of what the dust fraction is of the soils that we're looking at. We did this for each soil going down the profile using this equation here. So this compares elemental concentrations in the rock, dust, and soil to be able to do some back calculations on what fraction of the soil is composed of dust compared to what fraction is composed from the weathering of, or from in-situ weathering. For the desert scrub soils, we saw dust fractions ranging from 2 to 21%. 21% was primarily the surface soils in the convergent landscape positions. What we were especially excited about was the estimates for the conifer soils that we weren't necessarily always actively thinking about. You think about a lot of dust in the desert scrub types of landscapes, but in the conifer system, we also saw estimates up to 19%, again, in the surface soils that I was referencing before. And if you think about how extensive these dust storms can be, it would make sense that the dust would be deposited in these forested systems, especially up on the ridgetops, and even thinking about the potential for trees to kind of act as a sink. The rough surfaces of the trees could also be accumulating some dust. So these were exciting estimates that kind of relate back to the story that we were seeing in the tau plots. We also have collected dust over the past couple of years and done some preliminary microprobe work, and so I just wanted to include this image as evidence that we do see weathered biotite in the dust. So there's strong likelihood that we've got weathered material coming in as dust deposition, and part of that enrichment in biotite definitely would contribute to all of this dust deposition occurring in the surface soils especially. This relates to some of the recent work in the literature that's specifically looking at dust as a potential nutrient supplier. This was done in the montane forests in the Sierras of California. And I thought this was especially interesting thinking about phosphorus. And this here in the red box is representing long-term soil production from phosphorus-poor bedrock. And then this is the phosphorus flux for the total dust input. So this is indicating that this is an important supplier of phosphorus to this ecosystem. When we take a look at phosphorus percentages for the desert scrub site, the X here represents the dust reference, and these are the soil profiles that we've been looking at in terms of the tau plot. So we do see that there is phosphorus coming in the dust at a greater concentration than what we see in the rock reference. When we go to the mixed conifer site, we also see a similar type of situation in terms of the dust reference, as well as what the phosphorus percentages are in the rock. So for the first part of my talk, we touched base on cross-scale weathering processes with an emphasis on mineral and elemental depletion and how this increases as we move up into the wetter, more productive ecosystems from the desert scrub site. We've considered the impact of landscape position, specifically documenting greater degrees of feldspar loss as well as elemental loss in these convergent landscapes, and identified the important role that dust plays in comprising the soil geochemistry of these soils, as well as thinking about this as a potential nutrient supplier. So this ties together some of the bulk soil weathering that we've been looking at. And what I'm going to be transitioning to now is thinking about more of this microscale. When we're working at the microscale and we see evidence for mineral weathering or elemental loss, what about the potential for biological drivers of the elemental or of the mineral weathering processes? And I always like to start out this part with this quote. So the world's largest mining operation is run by fungi. And this leads to one of the ongoing research questions with my group, which is, what is the role of microbial and fungal communities in driving the initial stages of mineral weathering in field systems? To address this question, we extended this field deployment to include the Calhoun Forest in South Carolina. And I could not talk about the Calhoun without introducing Dan Richter. So I think Dan's here somewhere, but we love the cartoon, so definitely had to integrate that in here. So he's going to be our fourth speaker today. So you'll be learning a lot more about the Calhoun from Dan, I'm sure. But the Calhoun is especially interesting because of its land use history. So scientists working in the Calhoun are considering bedrock soil plant interactions, as well as the impact that people, specifically farming activities, and the massive erosion that occurred as a result of the farming activities have on this type of landscape. And so in the 1950s, farming was abandoned, trees were replanted, and this has been a really exciting point of study because scientists have been collecting data on these sites, on the soils, on the trees for over 70 years now. So it's a very strong record that the Calhoun Critical Zone Observatory is built on. So I think it's an excellent foundation to consider. And I just wanted to include a couple of photos of what I'm talking about when we discuss massive erosion, and then the exciting kind of regeneration of some of the forest here. And this is a picture of what the landscape looks like today in some of the hardwood forest areas. And why it's interesting to us from a climate perspective is that the Calhoun conveniently has a series of north-facing hill slopes where we could set up a comparable study with those divergent convergent landscape positions, and we also have comparable parent material. So the main thing that we were interested in is kind of developing this humid, wetter type of end to our climate gradient. So mean annual precipitation here is 127 centimeters compared to the max of 85 centimeters in the mixed conifer system of the Catalina CZO. So this kind of set up a more broad scale climate gradient for us to deploy our experiment in. And this experiment focused on these mineral mesh bags. So I learned about this technique from a group in the University of Sheffield, Jonathan Leake and Joe Quirk specifically. And the idea here is that you deploy mesh bags to understand mineral transformations. You can do this in lab or controlled systems, but also deploy it in field systems. And I really wanted to try to distinguish some weathering features using different types of mesh. So when you hear me refer to coarse mesh, I'm referencing 35 micron mesh with the idea that fungal hyphae would be able to grow into this mesh, but it would exclude large plant roots. The fine mesh was half micron mesh size, so we were assuming this was either going to be an in-situ control, we weren't sure if water would be flowing into it, or it was going to represent a way for us to get at bacterial inputs, organic coatings, more maybe chemical weathering features where you have water moving through, but no fungal hyphae. So coarse mesh, fungal accessible, fine mesh, non-fungal accessible was kind of the idea that we wanted to test here. There are three types of ground rock that we heat sealed into the nylon mesh bags. The ground rock range from 250 to 53 microns. We use basalt. So in a granitic terrain, we were looking at this as the bait. This is fine grains, different types of nutrients or potential nutrients, calcium, phosphorus, iron as a few examples. In contrast, we use quartz sand. This is coarse grain, not so much on the nutrient side of things, but we thought this would represent a helpful background control in terms of what the foraging activities may be of the fungal hyphae. And then we use granite. So this is coarse grain material freshly supplied from the desert CZO site in the Catalinas, where you have potential sources, or where you have sources of calcium, magnesium, iron, and calcium. The one thing I wanted to emphasize here is these are the same exact rock types that Dragos just presented to you on for Biosphere 2. So the idea here is that down the line, we would like to do a comparison between the controlled system, the controlled weathering system that he looked at, as well as thinking about what happens with these rocks when you deploy them in field environments as well. These were deployed across the two landscape positions that I was referring to previously, these divergent watershedding positions and convergent footslope positions. Each of these red squares represents a 1 meter squared plot. And so there were three plots per landscape position, and we repeated this pairing, this divergent-convergent pair. We repeated it in three watersheds for each CZO site. So we have this deployed in the Calhoun, in the Catalina Desert, and the Catalina Mixed Conifer position, and each of these plots contained between 18 to 24 bags with this type of distribution between rock type and the mesh size. And we set this up to run for 5 years total. So we'll be retrieving bags. We retrieved year one last fall, year three is next year, and then we'll be doing year five. So the initial objectives of this work, the overall goal is to differentiate mineral weathering features in these ground rock samples and to explore these features across climate as well as topographic gradients. But some of the initial objectives that we're just getting into as we retrieve bags and get going on this, based on some reviewer feedback, the very first step was to detect microbial inputs after such a short period of time. After 6 months, do we see fungal growth? Do we see any evidence of bacterial inputs, organic coatings, and these types of things? What about after 1 year? So that was one of the things that we just wanted to confirm. And then we also want to confirm the use of this bag, the use of this additional mesh type, and being able to differentiate weathering features down the line in this experiment, and even the being able to differentiate between the proposed drivers of mineral weathering in some of our initial pilot data collected at 6 months and 1 year. So as I start showing some of these images, I want to express some excitement for the next couple of photos here, because this was a long time coming. So it took several years to make the bags, deploy them, go retrieve them, and then get the opportunity to use the instrumentation at the Pacific Northwest National Lab to do some imaging on the rocks. And so it was a very exciting moment when we started looking at some of these grains and started detecting the fungal hyphae growing across the grain. So this is one of the first examples here from the Calhoun. This is one of the basalt samples. And I want to bring your attention to the fungal hyphae anchored at this point, and it's moving along the grain face here. And the exciting thing about the helium ion microscope is the incredible detail that you can get on these images. So you can learn a lot about the complexity of the mineral surface, and you can get a lot of information on some of the biological specimens that you may see in the growing in these bags as well. And I encourage you, as I move through some of these slides, to pay attention to some of the different even surface morphologies of the fungal hyphae and the grain characteristics that you can identify moving through some of these samples. Another exciting aspect from the Calhoun work, I only saw these in the convergent landscape positions using the fine mesh bags. And now this was an initial survey, but we are going to be spending more time the next couple of years looking to identify more of these types of coatings. But I wanted to bring your attention to the edge of the mineral grain here, and then just start looking at some of the coatings that we're seeing to the right. And when we take a closer look at this, we're thinking that this is some type of organic coating, biofilm, some type of interface between some type of microbe-mineral interface. And the things that we're interested in developing techniques for at the National Lab are thinking about ways to extract these types of coatings through some organic extractions, getting an idea of what is really comprised of these coatings, but then also getting at the mineral interface and thinking about the impact that these coatings and other types of microbe-mineral interactions are having on the geochemistry at these mineral surfaces. And again, this is something we only saw in these convergent positions in these fine mesh bags. So it's one of those characteristics. We saw fungal hyphae, but we are also being able to differentiate some of the coatings. One additional example I wanted to include for the Calhoun that we were especially excited by is for the divergent landscape position. This is from the granite mesh bag, and what you're looking at here is quartz sand, and this is, again, fine mesh. And so in these sections, you can see very clean quartz sand surfaces in this region of the grain. When you analyze that, it comes out you've got a little bit of carbon coating with the SEM analyses, but it's primarily quartz. But then when you start looking around different sections of the grain, I want to bring your attention to this section here. And as we start taking a closer look, we're actually seeing some type of coating that has dried out on the surface of this grain. And when we start doing point analyses of these, we actually see that this is some type of iron-rich coating. With the semi-quantitative estimates that came with this, it was between 2 and 5% in terms of the iron. And we were also back and forth on what type of coating this could potentially be, abiotic or biotic. But we see a bit of a jump up in the carbon compared to what the background looked like for the plain quartz sand coating. So we're thinking it may be some type of organic iron-rich coating. But this is, again, another type of interaction that we want to identify and explore in more detail, because we did, again, see a lot of this in the Calhoun sites especially. These are just some examples of some of the quick maps that we did here. I wanted to bring your attention to the iron, again, the greater intensity of iron in the upper left-hand quarter of that grain. And then you can start picking up the stronger quartz signatures, even where that cracking occurred. You can kind of see the evidence for the underlying silicone with the quartz. So this is another type of technique that we're using just to get some preliminary ideas of some of these grain features that we're seeing. The Catalina CZO was also extremely exciting because these were the pilot data points. So 6 months, these bags were deployed in these landscapes, and we saw evidence for fungal growth in both the desert scrub as well as the mixed conifer sites. And this is another example of what one of the structures looks like. Based on what we saw in the literature, we're thinking that these are actually bacterial associations adhered to this cylindrical fungal structure here. And then these also grow off, and these sections here are what interact with the grains. So we see this pretty frequently, as you can see in this example. You'll see a lot of grains, but then you can spot the fungal hyphae growing around the rocks. And one of the most exciting aspects of this was after 6 months, this is a biotite grain, we're already seeing the fungal hyphae growing in between the layers of biotite. So they're not just growing on top of the grains. They're growing through some of these interlayer spaces. And this is, again, the type of surface that we are going to be looking to do some additional work on in terms of understanding what is exactly happening here, if you're able to remove the hyphae and do some more analyses at that specific surface. And this is, again, emphasizing that we had mica. This is looking at mica, specifically biotite, in this granite rock. But we also saw interactions with the feldspars. And again, the quartz, the hyphae were there, but we didn't see a whole lot in terms of any growth or anything like what we saw growing between the interlayer space of the biotite mica. So coming back to some of the questions, does the in-soil mesh bag technique differentiate the proposed drivers of weathering? And I would say yes, to a degree. So for the fine mesh bags, especially these deployed in the Calhoun sites, we're seeing this differentiation. We're seeing different types of organic coatings, potentially iron-rich coatings, using these types of this type of mesh. We're seeing a lot of fungal hyphae in the coarse mesh bags. But the thing I want to emphasize here, this has not been perfect for excluding fungal hyphae. I actually refer to the hyphae that I'm finding in the fine mesh as infiltrators, because how are they getting in there? So we're thinking that there may be something with the heat seal, that they're getting in through the heat seal. But we are working to develop a hypholength measurement technique, and I am thinking that we will find a greater amount of hyphae in the coarse mesh bags compared to the fine mesh. So we see them in the fine mesh, but we're also able to differentiate where the hyphae are growing from where we see some of these organic coatings, at least in some of the initial stages of this work. So in terms of some of the current and future research directions, we currently are working with the Pacific Northwest National Lab to conduct some additional analyses on these samples. We're really focused on some of the soluble geochemistry, but also these organics. So we want to do some of these extracts on the grains to try to get at whether we have bacterial inputs or fungal inputs. A student of mine in my group is developing a hypholength measurement technique. So this will be using optical microscopy to get an idea of how much hyphae you have in each of these bags and be able to make comparisons between rock types, mesh types, landscape position, the two climate zones, and these types of things. We're also going to continue and do some more extensive imaging from the nano to microscale. We want to integrate some type of grain or grain counts or transects identifying or confirming the interactions with the hyphae, and also coupling this helium ion microscope technique with this focused ion beam technique, SEM, transmission electron microscopy, these types of things. So we're developing a technique to be able to look at the same mineral, take that stub, and go between these different instruments to really get a well-rounded perspective on what's going on at these surfaces. And then for every bag that comes out, we are saving a subset for microbial community DNA sequencing. So we are trying to get at this question of who is there, both in the bulk soil as well as inside the mesh bags, and then coupling that with the work that I've been talking with you today and some of these proposed research directions. And I wanted to end with one of the favorites so far from this work, and this is, again, one of the types of interfaces that we're really interested in working on. So this is an example from the Calhoun, again, the convergent position. And I want to bring your attention to this grain here. So we were going through and identifying what types of minerals we were seeing the fungal hyphae adhere to as we went through the sample. And when you take a closer look at this, you can actually see that this grain is actually not adhered to the stub, which I think was making the scientists working with me a bit nervous, but we had faith in the fungal hyphae that it would hold on and not do anything to the instrument. And you can see how it is attached, the fungal hyphae is attached to these two grains and well-rounded right here. So we moved on from this grain, and I realized we didn't get a point analysis of that, and I asked to go back to take another look at this. And what had happened, so you can kind of see how that grain is sitting now, when we went back, it had actually flipped up. And that gave us this whole new perspective, just by luck, just by going back to this grain after we'd already been moving around. And what I want to bring your attention to is the hyphae right here that was pulled away, and then that section of the grain interface. So as we get closer, we're thinking that this may be some type of evidence of hyphal tunneling or some type of evidence that there's been interaction between that fungal hyphae and the grain surface. And this type of surface is what we're going to be looking for and looking to identify as we move forward with this type of work. And we want to, again, use that focus ion beam technique and combine it with being able to look at what's going on right at that interface with the grain. So in terms of coming back to today's objectives, yes, we can detect microbial inputs. We're detecting fungal inputs across all sites. After 1 year, we're also seeing this in the Calhoun, including additional bacterial components. In terms of an in-soil mesh bag technique, we are seeing to a degree that we're able to differentiate some of these potential inorganic coatings or organic coatings in the fine mesh compared to what we see in the coarse mesh with a greater degree of fungal hyphae. At least that's what I'm expecting to see when we do the hyphal length measurements. So coming back to this figure that I shared at the beginning, we already are aware of and talk about the complexity of mineral weathering in this type of soil environment. But I think this this work is already demonstrating a greater degree of complexity than what we're seeing here in terms of coatings on iron-rich organic coatings, potentially on quartz grains, or the fungal networks that are growing through the biotite micas in these types of minerals. So we're headed this way in terms of thinking about the biological impacts and the greater degree of complexity. And I think this is just something important to keep in mind as we discuss mineral weathering and the different impacts it has on the ecosystem. So with that, I would like to acknowledge IMSL, the Pacific Northwest National Lab, for the funding, the rapid access proposal, and the science theme proposal for looking at this work. Craig Rasmussen on our work on the Catalina CZO cross-scale weathering mechanisms. And then the collaborators for this mesh bag project include Paul Schroeder and Jay Austin at the University of Georgia. The CalZone group overall, it's a very wonderful group to be associated with. Dragos from Georgia Tech, as well as Rachel Gallery, soil ecologist at the University of Arizona, who were working together on the microbial DNA sequencing work. And then lab and field assistants from students and others. But overall, thank you.